Welcome back to Naptime Nancy True Crime Podcast, and Happy New Year, everybody. Before we get into today's episode, I first want to thank those who listened to episode 6, which is a two-part episode regarding how PTSD crept up on me after years of avoiding telling anyone about my own sexual assault experience from college. Who my rapist is and where he's at now is even more disturbing. It was bittersweet hearing from so many of you and of your own stories. While I'm so glad we survivors have each other to encourage and support, I'm pissed off that there are so many of us. But I really do appreciate all of you sharing your stories, truly. And I take comfort in knowing that sharing my story helps some other survivors feel less alone and at least contemplate getting help regarding their own mental health struggles from PTSD. On to some more positive news. I started a Patreon.com account. Patrons have access to many episodes that I call power naps, as well as Naptime Nancy swag like stickers, buttons, all that good stuff. A quarter of all Patreon proceeds will be donated to DNA Doe Project to help identify Jane Does and John Does and solve missing person cases via familial DNA. DNADoeProject.org was founded by the help of Colleen Fitzpatrick. For those who don't know, Colleen Fitzpatrick has helped solve many cold cases within the last couple years alone, including identifying the Golden State Killer. DNA Doe Project has also given names back to many unidentified persons thus far, and counting. So a huge thank you is owed to my first patrons to sign up thus far. Melly, Chris, Jules, Michelle, Courtney, Andy, and Reverend Nate, you are my real MVPs. I so appreciate your support. Also, thank you to Tales of True Crime Podcast and JN Fawcett for your 5-star reviews on iTunes. 5-star reviews and clicking subscribe to Naptime Nancy Podcast on iTunes or whichever listening app you're into help my podcast so much. So thank you. Also, big thank you to my parents who not only gave me life, but gave me birthday money to put towards this podcast, to which I will be able to pay for the next few episodes to be edited, including this one, which is huge. Very thankful to have such incredible support from my loved ones for doing what I love to do, which is this, sharing unsolved cases and trying to help people in any way I can. Be sure to also check out my Naptime Nancy merch shop on spreadshirt.com/naptime-nancy-podcast. All available designs are created by me. And now, having much of my wardrobe ordered from Spreadshirt, I can attest to the quality of their work because I'm shameless and wear my own merch on the regular. If you haven't listened to Missing Maura Murray podcast, you should do that. Go ahead and click subscribe and binge all the way through as Tim and Lance walk you through the February 9th, 2004 disappearance of then 21-year-old UMass nursing student Maura Murray, who crashed her car on a windy road in the midst of the White Mountains in Bath, New Hampshire, and has not been heard from or seen since. And once you're caught up on all Maura Murray episodes, then go check out the episode that aired December 26, as Tim, Lance, and I discuss the 1990 disappearance of 24-year-old University of Maryland, Baltimore County student, Thecam Tran, and the 1976 disappearance of 31-year-old Navy Chief Warrant Officer Elaine Faye Lettinen from her home in Napa Valley, California. Thank you again to Tim and Lance for having me on Missing Maura Murray podcast. Your guys' show was one of the first podcasts I really got into, so it was so cool to be interviewed by you guys. Thank you also to my friend and patron, Michelle, who volunteers for private investigations for the missing, for helping to coordinate the interview as well. And last but not least, keep your eyes and ears peeled for Bill Huffman's new podcast, My Passion Case. Bill has a bunch of great guests lined up for his new show, and he and I have plans to discuss a missing woman from a nearby town where I grew up. And you won't want to miss it. It's some tea. Okay, we're good to go on announcements. My kids are asleep. Let's do this. It's time to talk some true crime during nap time. Settle up, partners, because this case is a trip. Actually, it's centered around an acid trip. And much like the acid trip that is the story of Alice in Wonderland, this case will take us all down many a rabbit hole. This is the disappearance of Brian Joseph Page. I'm going to walk you through the timeline to the best of our public knowledge. The rest is up to anyone out there listening who may have tips to turn into police. Brian Joseph Page was born March 15th, 1958. Those who knew him called him Joe. So I will be referring to him as Joe throughout the episode in hopes of sparking the memories of those who recall his disappearance. Joe was a junior at Franklin High School in Portland, Oregon. I haven't really read too much about what Joe was like as a person, but he had a very sweet face as a 16-year-old kid in his yearbook. On Saturday, January 11th, 1975, Joe, his 19-year-old neighbor friend David, and both of their sisters headed less than an hour south from Portland to Oregon's capital city, Salem. Joe and David's sisters headed to a different party, while Joe and David stayed at the party located near the corner of 25th and Northeast State Street in Salem. If you look at this area on Google Earth, there's a plaid pantry on that corner. Not sure if it was still a plaid pantry in 75. And a cluster of apartment buildings and homes directly east behind 25th Street is the Oregon State Penitentiary. And to the northeast is the Oregon State Hospital Museum of Mental Health, which used to be the Oregon State Hospital, which is where One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was actually filmed and was released in 1975. I will not be giving the full names of either sister or David's full name, as no one has ever been acknowledged as a suspect in Brian Joseph Page's disappearance, if this case even involves a suspect. By the time that Joe and David's sisters got back to the party that Joe and David were attending, Joe and David had decided to drop some acid, aka the hallucinogenic known as lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD, a popular drug to experiment with in the 70s. I've never done it, but I, of course, don't judge anyone who has. It's just that stories like this one keep me from ever having the desire to try LSD. I tried to reach out to Joe's sisters to see if they would be willing to answer a few questions that I had that might help narrow the search down for their brother, but I hadn't heard anything back, which is completely understandable and respectable. I am, however, available anytime if they ever want to get in touch in the future. So down for a follow-up episode. According to comments allegedly left by one of Joe's sisters on websleuths.com, she states that Joe's friend David started to have a really bad acid trip and took off out the door of the house party. Joe's sister then encouraged Joe to go after David to help calm him down. David and Joe then took off in David's aqua or turquoise 1962 Volkswagen Bug around approximately 2 a.m. The temperature between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. in Salem, Oregon, in the wee hours of January 12, 1975, ranged from 38 degrees to 49 degrees Fahrenheit. I apologize to anyone who uses a metric system. In the future, I will definitely break this down, but I forgot to do it this time. So it was chilly, but not necessarily icy on the roads, unless you drove to a high enough elevation. No reports of rainfall that evening either. It is unclear who was driving when David and Joe left, but only David would turn up nearby, mere hours later, in handcuffs. Between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m., David broke into Capital Chevrolet and Cadillac dealership that was then located at 605 Commercial Street Northeast in Salem, Oregon. I mapped out the distance from the house party to this car dealership. It's 2 miles. That's it. So in that 3 to 4 hours time, David is found just 2 miles away from the house party. He broke into the office of the car dealership, stole the keys to a 1973 Chevrolet Chevelle Laguna, and took off down the wrong way of the one-way commercial street. According to the Statesman Journal, witnesses saw David driving erratically and in the wrong direction of the one-way commercial street and phoned police. When David saw Salem police on his tail, he took off. Police wound up catching and arresting David and charging him with unauthorized use of a vehicle and eluding the police. When asked why he had stolen the car and fled from police, David claimed he thought he was in hell. It's unclear if David brought up his missing friend Joe at that time, or their acid trip, or even the fact that David's own vehicle was missing at the time, or if it was Joe's parents themselves that had to report Joe missing. According to Joe's sister's comments on Web Sleuth, the officer that arrived to speak with the Page family regarding their missing son was cold and flippant toward the family, stating that Joe likely ran away, kids do it all the time, blah, blah, blah. And the family felt that judgment had been cast upon their teenage son's experimental drug use. I love when you hear about missing persons being ignored because of experimenting with drugs or in other cases due to their lifestyle, especially when it's missing children. They're all missing persons. They all matter. One day, I hope we can get past this as a society because it still happens. Joe's sister states that their mother was incredibly hurt by the callousness of the officer. It seemed as though Salem police wanted to pass the case off to Portland police since Joe was from Portland. And Portland police wanted Salem police to handle the case because Joe went missing from Salem. What a mess. Sadly, Joe's mother has since passed away, never receiving answers as to what happened to her baby boy in the wee hours of that Super Bowl Sunday morning, January 12, 1975. Brian Joseph Page was just 2 months shy of turning 17 when he disappeared, along with his 19-year-old friend David's 1962 Volkswagen Bug. Joe had his whole life ahead of him. So what happened to Joe? Is he still out there alive? Did he crash his friend's VW Bug and the car hasn't surfaced in 45 years? Or did Joe encounter a more sinister fate? I think in order to dissect the theories of what happened to Joe that morning, we first need to discuss the facts and myths that surround the drug LSD. This is a direct quote regarding the history of LSD, as stated from the website drugfreeworld.org. Albert Hoffman, a chemist working for Sandoz Pharmaceutical, synthesized LSD for the first time in 1938 in Basel, Switzerland, while looking for a blood stimulant. However, its hallucinogenic effects were unknown until 1943, when Hoffman accidentally consumed some LSD. It was later found that an oral dose of as little as 25 micrograms, equal in weight to a few grains of salt, is capable of producing vivid hallucinations. Because of its similarity to a chemical present in the brain and its similarity in effects to certain aspects of psychosis, LSD was used in experiments by psychiatrists through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. While the researchers failed to discover any medical use for the drug, the free samples supplied by Sandoz Pharmaceuticals for the experiments were distributed broadly, leading to a wide use of the substance. LSD was popularized in the 1960s by individuals such as psychologist Timothy Leary, who encouraged American students to turn on, tune in, and drop out. This created an entire counterculture of drug abuse and spread the drug from America to the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe. Even today, use of LSD in the United Kingdom is significantly higher than other parts of the world. Psychiatric mind control programs focusing on LSD and other hallucinogens created a generation of acid heads. While the 1960s counterculture used the drug to escape the problems of society, the Western intelligence community and the military saw it as a potential chemical weapon. In 1951, these organizations began a series of experiments. U.S. researchers noted that LSD, quote, is capable of rendering whole groups of people, including military forces, indifferent to their surroundings and situations, interfering with planning and judgment, and even creating apprehension, uncontrollable confusion, and terror, end quote. Experiments in the possible use of LSD to change the personalities of intelligence targets and to control whole populations continued until the United States officially banned the drug in 1967. Use of LSD declined in the 80s, but picked back up again in the 1990s. For a few years after 1998, LSD had become more widely used at dance clubs and all-night raves by older teens and young adults. But use dropped significantly in 2000 or so. Now, let's break down some myths about LSD. These are excerpts from the site verywellmind.com in an article titled Five Common LSD Myths Debunked. Myth number one, dropping acid will make you a better person. Many people report pleasant experiences on LSD and even attribute great insights to the drug. Perhaps more importantly, there are many reports of the exact opposite happening. After taking LSD, people have been found to develop mental and emotional difficulties. In fact, LSD is more likely to alienate you from other people and muddle your mental and emotional understanding than to lead you to a superior level of consciousness. Myth number two, a friend or guide can prevent you from having a bad trip. While having a supportive friend can often help with a bad trip, even people of experience with LSD and training in psychotherapy are sometimes unable to prevent others from having a negative reaction to the drug. Friends can easily be perceived as enemies by someone experiencing paranoia while they are tripping. And there are plenty of examples of people having bad trips while in the company of those who care about them. Myth number three. Orange juice or vitamin C will stop a trip. By the time LSD takes effect, your body has already metabolized the drug. The trip is actually the after effects on your brain, and any improvements felt from drinking orange juice are a placebo effect or simply calming effect on the body from taking a drink. Myth number four, once you take acid, it never leaves your body. While flashbacks can occur after taking LSD, this is not the result of the release of the drug. In fact, LSD is an unstable drug which breaks down easily and passes through the body quickly.
Hello, true crime recruits. I am Margot, the host of Military Murder, a podcast that focuses on the things I love the most, true crime and the military. Because yes, people in the military commit murder too. But don't worry, no military knowledge required. This is a straight true crime podcast. I have already covered a soldier-on-soldier decapitation, a catfish murder that led to the death of an innocent Marine, the case of the newlywed murders in my Marines Killing Marines episode, and there are so many more to come. Join me each Monday as I tell these tales, ask provoking questions along the way, and, well, keep you true crime lovers entertained while you do your routine things, like commuting, working out, or even food shopping. So, if you cannot get enough of Investigation Discovery, The Oxygen Network, or your favorite true crime podcast, head on over to any podcast app and search Military Murder for your next true crime binge. I can't wait for you to join my true crime army. Happy binging.
Myth number 5. Acid is the key to unlocking the unconscious mind. The truth is taking LSD might get you thinking about things in a way you haven't thought of before, but it does not give you a key to inner workings of your mind. Acid is just as likely to get you thinking about things that have no basis in reality as uncovering hidden truths. And just because you have taken LSD and thought about your past, it doesn't mean you know or understand everything that has happened to you. In an attempt to further understand LSD, to understand how, if it is possible, that David truly doesn't recall what happened to his friend Joe in his own car that fateful January night in 1975, I asked a doctor friend of mine who specializes in psychological trauma. This is a direct quote from her text responses to me regarding the effects of LSD on our memory and subconscious. Yeah, LSD can lead to memory loss, but so can trauma. Both compounded can cause serious memory lapses. That being said, it would be highly unlikely that someone would completely forget every single detail of that evening. Fragments would remain, like when a glass explodes from heat in a room. Shards remain in the wall no matter how much you clean it out. End quote. So what does this tell us about LSD and what happened to Brian Joseph Page? Well, all it really tells us is that deep down, David could likely still have some potentially crucial clues and details as to what happened to his friend that night, whether he realizes it or not. Does it mean that David hurt his friend Joe while they were on acid and abandoned his own vehicle? Absolutely not. But unfortunately, without more information, the theory simply cannot be ruled out. And that's why I'm choosing not to publicly state David's full name. What I really want to know is what David looked like when he was arrested for stealing that 1973 Laguna from Capital Chevrolet, mere hours after he and Joe left the party that was just down the road a couple miles. Were his clothes dirty? Wet? Were they bloody? Anything? Had he really only traveled 2 miles in a few hours' time? Could David and Joe have fought in the car? The car crashed into the water and somehow David made it out alive and Joe didn't? If an accident had occurred, David's clothes would have been wet. And then it seems odd that he wouldn't have mentioned any of these concerns to law enforcement. I have scoured Google Earth, searching for any anomalies in bodies of water around the Salem area. According to Joe's sister's web sleuth comments, a psychic told the Page family that Joe was driving and just trying to sober up and wound up in Detroit Lake. Detroit Lake is approximately 60 miles from where Joe and David had left the house party. But Detroit Lake gets so low in the summertime that it seems nearly impossible for the VW bug, especially such a light color like turquoise, to go unnoticed for 45 years. So to me, Detroit Lake theory seems unlikely, but the scenario of Joe plummeting into a deep body of water itself still seems plausible, unfortunately. The biggest body of water that would be the easiest to make a vehicle seemingly disappear happens to be the closest body of water to where Capital Chevrolet was located. Commercial Street runs parallel to the Willamette River. That said, an Oregonian on Web Sleuth who calls himself Cipher Hunting Family made an interesting comment in 2018 regarding the Willamette River that I want to share. Here's the quote. I came across Brian's missing person information and am so struck by it. Like someone said earlier, the Willamette River is the largest body of water in Salem and it flows north to Portland. I've grown up here since the mid-80s and we have had several floods and droughts and the river has been dredged a few times for the ferry that is just north of Salem and for a boat called the Willamette Queen. I would think that the VW would have been discovered. The other thing that Salem has are several quarries filled with water that are very deep, The state stocks most of them. I wonder if they've ever been looked into. End quote. Quarries are a very interesting thought. There are also many nearby logging roads just outside the city limits. But unfortunately, good luck getting a quarry to drain the areas that they dredge sand out of the river, though. And any place the car could be in a landfill and/or quarry could long since be buried deep from a bulldozer on that property. But with quarries and logging roads, David would need to figure out how to get himself back to Commercial Street by 6 a.m. to steal the 1973 Laguna. So perhaps David wasn't with Joe in the vehicle if his car headed out of town. Or Joe was left in an area and the Volkswagen was hidden or dumped into water not far from Capital Chevrolet. David was clever enough to break into dealership's office to get the keys, so he had some wits about him that morning of his arrest. While the Willamette River comments made by the Web Sleuth poster about the car going missing in the river seem like a less likely theory, it's still not impossible. This case has bothered me for years now. In December of 2018, I recall being over at my parents' house and watching the news piece regarding the 40th anniversary of his arrest, for lack of a better term, of construction worker / part-time clown for children's parties, serial killer John Wayne Gacy from Norwood Park, Illinois. Gacy killed 33 young men from 1972 to 1978. Many of his victims he buried under the crawl space of his own home. Talk about nightmare fuel. Six of those 33 young men had not been identified at the time. Two composite sketches of unidentified victims number 10 and number 13 appeared on the screen. Both sketches bore a close resemblance to Brian Joseph Page. I thought about Joe immediately. And I was not the only person to think so. The Web Sleuth site was abuzz with talk of Joe's resemblance to the sketches as well, as was Reddit. But both of the victims depicted in the sketches are thought to have been killed from 1976 to 1977. Joe's sister states that Joe had always been thoughtful and good about checking in with their parents, and it doesn't seem likely that Joe would have been held captive for a year before being killed by Gacy in order to be victim number 10 or 13. But given that LSD can have long-term emotional effects, I suppose Joe could have taken off. But I just don't buy it personally. But maybe. There is one unidentified Gacy victim that fits the few physical descriptions available, as well as the timeline. The victim that the Chicago Tribune refers to as victim number 28, age range 14 to 18, height 5'6" to 5'11" tall, and the timeline he was murdered was from January 3rd, 1972 to July 31st, 1975. Joe was 5'6" to 5'8" tall and nearly 17 years of age. Could this be Joe? Has DNA ever been tested and ruled out to be certain? Is there a possibility that Brian Joseph Page could have encountered a serial killer? Possibly. But Gacy feels like a stretch, in my opinion. It would seem more likely that Robert Kraft, who alleged to have killed some boys and girls along the West Coast in the 70s, would have been the culprit of Joe's disappearance logistically. But I suppose, sadly, anything is possible when it comes to serial killers and their victims. That said, I've yet to find any information about John Wayne Gacy having Oregon ties. And it seems unlikely that Joe would have made it clear to Chicago, which is approximately 648 miles from the house party Joe and David left from Salem, Oregon, and not phoned anyone he knew. So personally, I'm just not buying it. This theory just seems like a far cry from Occam's razor. But hey, stranger things have happened. The whole idea of Joe running away from home after a bad acid trip, stealing his friend's car, ditching his own sister, and never returning just does not add up to me after seeing his sister's comments about Joe being good about checking in with his parents. Seems way more likely that his intent was to sober up. But if that's the case, then what happened to David being in the vehicle? Where was David dropped off? What time? David was the one who was reportedly distraught and having a bad trip from the LSD that he and Joe took. When Joe's sister saw David leave, she felt bad for David and urged Joe to go after him and help ease his mind, help him out of his bad trip. Can you imagine that being the last time you saw your sibling, urging them to go after someone having a bad trip and never seeing them again? I feel terrible for her. She was just trying to help out her and Joe's neighbor and friend. Whatever happened to Joe should not be on Joe's sister's conscience. But letting go of that guilt is easier said than done, I'm sure.
Maine, the northernmost state in America, usually thought of as a quaint, safe vacation destination. Our motto is, the way life should be. But did you know serial killer John Joseph Joubert was raised in Maine and was convicted of 3 stabbing murders of young boys? Or the unsolved abduction of baby girl Ayla Reynolds, supposedly stolen from her bed near Christmas 2011. Her body has never been found. These are just 2 of the Maine stories Murderific has covered. We cover crimes from all areas and Maine cases as well. Murderific True Crime Podcast, hosted by me, Bernadette, can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or go to murderific.com. We will be executing podcasts 1 crime at a time.
Back to David and his bad acid trip. We don't know what David's mental health was like before taking LSD that night. But the amount of stress that he was under at that time in his life, whether or not David had a history of violence or whether or not he suffered from depression and or anxiety, plays a huge factor in how he would have reacted to the LSD. When David was arrested for stealing the car a few hours after he and Joe left the party, David told police that he stole the car and fled because he thought he was in hell. I'm so curious what Joe must have looked like to him. Did he even know it was Joe that chased after him at the party? Was he hallucinating and thought someone was stealing his car and the struggle ensued? Did Joe insist on driving and David demanded to be let out of the car? Was David driving? Or did he jump from the moving vehicle? Was this party at a house or apartment buildings? Perhaps there are more local Salem witnesses out there that might recognize this story. Obviously, something dramatic happened between Joe and David for them to part ways. Whether David jumped out of the vehicle and Joe kept driving, or whether David no longer saw his friend and was hallucinating that Joe was somehow a threat to his own safety. I personally believe David really did think he was in hell while under the influence of LSD. And possibly lashed out, thinking he had to use self-defense. But if that's the case, then David would have had to have sobered up enough to have realized he mistook his friend for a monster, then had to hide both Joe and his own vehicle well enough to conceal for 45 years, and then steal a car and take police on a high-speed chase. David wound up pleading guilty to charges of unauthorized use of a vehicle, but the charges for burglary of Capital Chevrolet and attempting to elude police were dropped mid-February of 1975. David received a suspended 1-year jail sentence and 3 years probation, according to a February 29, 1975 article in the Statesman Journal. That said, I could find very little regarding David's criminal record since then. I did, however, find his name listed among a group of people who donated to help a stolen classic car that was stripped and returned years later in the Portland area, perhaps trying to spread some kindness for things that he regrets during his adolescence, an act of kindness which I felt was worth mentioning nonetheless. On January 20th, 1975, a Statesman Journal article stated that an anonymous tipster phoned police and told them that they might want to search the Wheatland, Oregon area for a, quote, something not alive anymore, end quote. Wheatland is a blip of farmland on Oregon's map, less than 15 miles north of Salem. The Wheatland Ferry has operated since the mid-1800s to connect commuters from Salem across the Willamette River into Newburgh and McMinnville. A search of the Wheatland area was conducted, but no human remains were found. Perhaps the person who phoned the tip in was slightly off their area description, if the tip was legitimate. But it sounds like it could be. Guilty conscience, perhaps? If that anonymous tipster is still out there, I wish they would give more information and clear their conscience as to what they witnessed, so that whomever's remains are possibly still out toward the Wheatland area may finally be put to rest with a proper burial. They are owed that respect. Their family is owed that respect. So, can you see why this case drives me and many others crazy? The rabbit holes are endless. Very little can be ruled out until we find out what happened to Brian Joseph Page and David's turquoise 1962 Volkswagen Bug. And this case has just not gotten the attention it needs for this to actually happen. I've been kicking myself for not covering this case earlier. Why? Because my father-in-law, who passed away this past July, grew up in Salem. He was the same age as David. Yeah, David and Joe were from Portland, but they could have had mutual friends who could have been at the same party for all I know. He could have possibly heard more details about the party or David's arrest. My husband grew up in the surrounding Salem area, so we travel from up near Portland down to Salem often. And I can't remember the last time that thoughts of what could have possibly happened to Joe hasn't crossed my mind. If alive, Brian Joseph Page would be turning 62 this March. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, aka NCMEC, has created an age-progressed composite of what Joe might look like in his late 50s. At the time of his disappearance, Brian Joseph Page went by his middle name, Joe. According to the Charlie Project website dedicated to missing and unidentified persons, Brian Joseph Page was 16, nearly 17, 5'6" to 5'8" tall, and 140 to 155 pounds, wavy light brown hair and brown eyes. He was a handsome kid with kind-looking eyes, said to be wearing a light blue shirt with Hilton on the shirt pocket. I'm not sure if this is in regards to the hotel or a brand of clothing or something else. He was also wearing blue jeans and brown hiking boots. Joe had one visible scar as of January 12, 1975, which was on his left arm. Brian Joseph Page was last seen near 25th and Northeast State Street in Salem, Oregon. Joe's friend David's 1962 Volkswagen Bug hasn't been seen since Joe went missing either. The Oregon license plate number is 7, P as in Paul, 3623. So if you've seen an abandoned two-door Volkswagen Bug or the license plate in the woods, in the water, concealed on someone's property that you think could have been aqua blue or turquoise at one time, please turn the tip in, just in case. Try not to touch anything, but do try to figure out where you are without disrupting a potential crime scene, if possible. Please contact Portland Police Department's Homicide and Missing Persons Unit at 503-823-0400 with any tips regarding Brian Joseph Page's whereabouts. And if you'd prefer to remain anonymous and email a tip, you can send it to me and I will send it to the police. Email me at naptimenancy@gmail.com. Thank you guys for listening. Next episode, we're going to discuss a serial killer who is yet to be caught and the potential killings that may be additional victims of this killer. So stay tuned and catch a nap time, my friends. Intro music is titled Backdoor Brawl by Mark Wallach, purchased from premiumbeats.com. Sources include newspapers.com, Statesman Journal articles from 1975, The Chicago Tribune, article dated 12/17/2018 by Corey Remore and Kyle Bentle, thecharlieproject.com, missingkids.org, Wikipedia, and portlandoregon.gov/police. Well, that's it for episode 7. Thanks for listening.